reflected upon our speaker, our dear brother, Will McNee.
Dear kind and gracious loving Heavenly Father, we bow this morning, Lord, once again to offer our humble thanks to Thee for the many privileges and for all Thy blessings granted unto us up till this time. We thank Thee once again that we are able to assemble here in convention and to feast upon Thy Word. We do ask a special blessing now upon Brother Will, as he will break the bread of life to us. We do ask that each unites his lips, that whatever he may say may bring honor and praise to Thee, and likewise may be an edification to us. We do ask Thee to bless each one here, and to open our hearts and minds, that whatever we may hear, we shall put to use, and that it may help us along this narrow way. We do ask Thee to bless all Thy dear children the world over, and we do ask Thee to forgive us when we come short. These favors we ask and pray in Jesus' dear name. Amen.
Now, dear friends, our speaker does not need an introduction to you because I'm sure he's known by you all. But he's more than known. I know that he's loved by you all. And the consideration of his heart and lesson today, it sounds like something that indeed will be helpful and beneficial to us. He has given it the title, The Trial of Your Faith. So we'll ask Brother Wilf McPhee to come forward with the Lord's blessing on his face.
Thank you, Brother Jerry. Well, good morning, dear brethren. We're happy to be here in Salem once again. And if it were given previously, I'm afraid, in case it wasn't given, I'd like to repeat it, that all the brethren in Vancouver and New Westminster area who did not come down send their love to you. Well, this morning, we thought perhaps the subject of faith would be helpful to us all. There are many subjects that we could choose. The theme of this convention seems to have been along the lines of exhortation and dedication to the Lord, an admonition to help us to prove faithful in carrying out our vows. So this subject, I think, will provide us with some stimulus to increase our faith and to strive to walk more worthily of the calling wherewith we have been called. I think probably whenever there is an immersion service and one has presented themselves before the brethren indicating their consecration to the Lord, it makes us, each one, think to ourselves, how is our own consecration? In 1 Peter 1:7, then, the setting for our subject, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. In other words, at the time of his second presence, we trust that we may be found faithful and appear with him to bless. The subject of faith, dear brethren, while it is found in the Old Testament, is really emphasized and clarified only when we come to the writings of the New Testament. As far as the word itself is concerned, faith means a persuasion, a conviction, reliance, constancy, and assurance. Now, if you want to remember the dictionary meaning of the word and try to remember how you should be constant and reliable, as well as relying on the Lord to have an assurance and so on, this would be very well, sort of little touchstones that you could think about occasionally. But faith involves a little more than just bare meanings of words. We are told in Hebrews 11:1 that faith is the basis of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen, and the guarantee of victory. So let us turn to 1 John 5:4 about this guarantee of victory. Whosoever or whatsoever is begotten of God overcometh the world. And this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. So then, a vital and lively faith is this guarantee of victory. Faith is the operation, the exercise of our minds in respect to God and His promises. That is a quotation from Volume 6, page 689. Faith was a part of Adam's character. But this faith that was such a vital part of Adam diminishes in his children as the years separating us from his perfection increase. A stronger spark of faith is inherited by some more than others. For example, we remember Timothy. Timothy was a young brother, and he received many words of admonishing and comfort from the Apostle Paul. But Timothy received his faith from his mother, and perhaps more particularly from his grandmother, Lois. This measure of faith that we may receive by inheritance must be increased by hearing the Word. While an appreciation of the beauties of the heavens and the earth may make us aware of a Creator, the only way to come to know Him is to be told about His character and about His loving intentions toward His creatures. This is quite true. You recall when we were studying in the first volume, isn't it, where we speak about proving the existence of an intelligent Creator aside from the Bible. We attempt to, or at least Brother Russell has lined it up for us, where we attempt to provide or prove the existence of a Creator by the things that are seen. As David has quoted, we look into the heavens and we contemplate their beauty, the pageantry of the stars as they are visible nightly. And how David enjoyed, of course, in his day, they didn't have too much in the way of electric lights, and oil lamps weren't the best for reading long into the night. So they had long nights to contemplate the heavens. Perhaps in our busy day, we don't stop to take advantage of some of these simpler things. But look into the heavens and observe their beauty and order. Look outside, particularly at this time of year in Salem, and look at the beauties of nature, the trees and the flowers coming into bloom. And who that has not contemplated these things has not come to the conclusion that there is an intelligent Creator? But that in itself would not tell you much more than that there was an intelligent Creator. So we must go to His Word to find out more about Him, about His character, and about what He has intended for His human creation. So this is found, dear brethren, by studying His Word, and our understanding will be increased by the use that we make of the helps that are provided for us. These helps are many and varied. And I don't think that we can get a better help than to remind ourselves that there is a means the Lord has provided us with in this end of the age that has been provided to help us understand this book. And we think these helps are, as you know, the studies in the Scriptures, so that if we need some help to understand the text, that is usually where we go, to find out what the volumes, as we refer to them as, have to say, as well as the tabernacle shadows and the reprints. These writings, we are convinced, were given to us by the Lord for this very purpose of helping us to understand our God and His purposes and to stimulate our faith. And I think that your faith today needs stimulating as perhaps at no other time, more so in the harvest period. Faith can be divided into two parts. The two parts are an intellectual assurance and a heart reliance. The first is the foundation of knowledge, upon which we build the second, the superstructure of trust in God. It is through knowledge that we come to an appreciation of this intelligent Creator and that He sent His only begotten Son to be our Redeemer. Based upon this knowledge, we are enabled to accept His invitation to dedicate our lives in His service. We cannot dedicate our lives to anything unless it is based on a certain amount of knowledge. Our faith thus far has been partly of inheritance and partly of knowledge. Henceforth, it is more closely related to our confidence and trust in God's promises as they relate to ourselves and to others. This is the superstructure of character development and can be considered a gift of the Spirit, being exhibited by the development of the fruits and the graces of the Spirit. Let us read a couple of texts that we have in 2 Timothy 1 and 5, speaking about Timothy. We want to quote, "When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also." And then we turn to the text which Brother George quoted, Galatians 5 and 22. "The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law." So then those that are governed by these things are developing in the likeness of Christ. They are putting on a character which will be pleasing and acceptable to God. Of course, usually the subject of faith involves rewards which are future. We are looking forward to receiving a reward. We don't usually think of having received it now, because what a man has, he doesn't hope for. And so we are hoping for something in the future, but nevertheless there are some present rewards of faith, and such as we might say, an appreciation of the truth. Let us never underestimate this favor from God, that He has favored us by an understanding of the truth. This is not generally understood today, as it will be in the kingdom. So this indeed is a present reward, and the realization that these things are hidden to others, but God has seen fit to reveal them to us. Again, let us read the text in 1 Corinthians 2, 9 and 10. Where we read, "It is written, I have not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love Him. But God hath revealed them unto us by His Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God." Then there is the appreciation of the heavenly things, the glories of the kingdom, and of our relationship to God as sons. We are sons of God. A proper faith, we believe, is manifested by works. Excuse me. For if we do not act on our faith, it will die out. And how true this is. Of course, our works must be in harmony with our faith and to the extent of our ability. We think this is very true, that what we do is a reflection of what we believe. And if we don't believe very strongly, then what we do will not react very strongly. So then we think that because of the times in which we are living, it behooves us to take heed unto our faith and to try to have a strong faith and act accordingly. Now, in the second chapter of James, we have a wonderful dissertation on the relationship of faith and works. The 14th verse, "What doth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he have faith and have not works? Can faith save him?" Or, of course, he means, can faith alone save him? The 17th, "Even so, faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone." So then we cannot stand alone. Charlie mentioned last night how we are like coals of fire which have to be heaped up together. Maybe in this day and age of gas furnaces and oil furnaces, we kind of lose the advantage of the illustration. But nothing illustrates it better than coals of fire. If you've ever had a fire out in the bush, if you're camping or maybe just burning stumps or something like that, you have a nice hot fire, and after the burning is done, it gradually dies down, and maybe you scatter the coals around so that you'll dissipate the fire and it won't spread or flare up. And you know how quickly it cools down. But if you want to restart the fire and you bank up those nice warm coals and put a little fresh kindling on, pretty soon you have a nice blaze again. So let us remember, we can't stand alone, and our faith can't stand alone. It must be accompanied, as James says, by some kind of works. Yea, a man may say, "Thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by works..." That doesn't sound quite right. "Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect?" So then, we must make this combination, faith and works. There are several things that we can do to increase our faith. We think that you're familiar with them, probably with a lot more reasons, but first of all, I think that we should remember to increase our faith is to have a vital, active prayer life. We want to go to the Lord earnestly in prayer. And don't forget that we believe in a God, a living God. Many people today don't believe in a living God. They believe that God has died. And perhaps we shouldn't be too hard on these people for being honest in their convictions. Because the God that they worshipped, if it were the God of the Dark Ages, a God of torment and so on, it's a good thing that he has died. Because that isn't the God we worship. We worship the true and living God. And so perhaps it is the work immediately before us when the kingdom is fully set up, that these people who are getting rid of those old ideas will have the knowledge of the truth to tell them about the true God. And then they will be able to exercise faith in the real, true, and living God. Then, when we seek the Lord earnestly in prayer, we want to seek to know more of his will for us, which is revealed to us in his word. And then when we find out what his word tells us about his will, then we want to obey the instructions contained there. To seek and to enjoy doing whatever we can in the divine service. To seek to put on the fruits and graces of the Holy Spirit. If we are going to live like a Christian, we are going to receive the same kind of treatment that our Master received. If you really meant what you said when you told the Lord that you would serve him, then, dear brethren, do not be surprised if he puts you to the test. We, of course, sometimes may think that it may sound a little discouraging, especially when someone has just symbolized their consecration. However, we think that it is something that we all must realize, that we have entered a way of sacrifice. We have entered in the way of following the footsteps of our Savior. And therefore, we are not above Him, and to be forewarned is forearmed, is it not? But then we must remember that Christ suffered, and the Christian, the follower of Christ, will also be expecting to receive some similar treatment. I always think of Moses in that connection, that he told the children of Israel that the Lord was going to put them to the test. He was going to prove them whether they loved the Lord, their God, with all their heart and strength. Moses was tested, Israel was tested, and spiritual Israel is tested. Peter says, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory shall be revealed, you also may be glad with exceeding joy. For you will be able to participate with Him in that glory." And as we are so near the time of remembering His death and our participation therein, we look forward soon, we trust, to partaking with Him anew in that cup. But it will be a cup of joy. In 1 Peter 4, 12 and 13 is where we were reading from. When His glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. "Yet if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf." Dear friends, in our text, faith is compared to gold, though it be tried with fire. So gold is usually associated with wealth, something precious, valuable. And men will spend much time and energy, and they'll suffer a great deal, not only of inconvenience, but physical suffering to obtain it, although it does not always bring the happiness that it is supposed to, and whatever it does bring is of a very temporary and unsatisfactory nature. I think it has already been expressed on the platform that men will spend their lives seeking faith, fame and fortune, but when they come to the end of their span of life, what good is it? It doesn't do them any good, and sometimes it does their posterity a lot of harm. So, therefore, we see that the searching out of this kind of riches is really not to the best advantage for anyone concerned. In comparison, faith is far more precious and valuable than gold is, because its rewards are greater and more valuable. They are more durable, and they are permanent. However, there is a similarity in obtaining the wealth of gold and the wealth of faith. Gold is found in the earth, but like most other metals, they are not a part of the earth. They are separate and distinct, and they must therefore be separated out from the earthly surroundings and refined. We understand that gold is refined by a heating process, and we know that faith is also refined by a heating process. Very high temperatures are needed to separate the dross, the impurities, from the gold before it is properly refined. Similarly, fiery trials are needed to burn out the dross from our characters and to crystallize a Christ-like character in us. I've never seen this done, but I've heard it referred to from the platform that when a refiner is refining gold and applies the heat to it, we can perhaps picture an old-fashioned cauldron full of gold and a terrific heat built up underneath it, and I'm sure most of you have seen a plumber with his little pot full of lead before he cocks the pipes, and sometimes it's a dirty film gathers on top of the molten metal. And I suppose this is similar to gold, that there would be a dirty film, the dross and the impurities would gather on the top, and they skim this off to get rid of it. And as the heat continues, gradually, I understand, the impurities all come to the top and are skimmed off, and then he can look down and see his reflection in this pure gold. This is what we are waiting for, or at least the Lord is waiting for, is the perfect reflection of his image in us, this gold being purified. And just to digress for a few minutes, we heard an illustration. Before I get to that illustration, I'll give you another illustration before I leave the mining picture. It is connected with my work that I get into a mine occasionally. And I'll just tell you a little bit about what I learned, how they refine or purify some iron ore. I think there are similar processes, but they use different means of separating out the ore. So we'll just use the iron as an illustration. We want to use this illustration to point out that in the development of Christian character, there is a crushing work that is going on in connection with your purification. So they have these open pits you hear about these days, and they use dynamite and they blast out the rocks. And they have great huge shovels which pick up the rock and put it into great big trucks, and then they truck it up to the crusher, the primary crusher. And this is made up of a large metal thing that it looks something like a great huge pear. And this piece of metal is going around and around quite slowly, and another, it's in a great huge metal bowl, but it's there's no bottom in it. As these large rocks drop into the crusher, you hear a tremendous grinding, grating, roaring noise as these big chunks of rock are ground inexorably into smaller pieces. And they drop through into the bottom, and they are carried on a belt to another crusher. Gradually, this crushing process goes on until they get it down to very small, fractured pieces of ore. And we think that this crushing process is going on in the lives of the Christian. First of all, you've got to break up the big lumps. And the Lord permits experiences to come upon us which does this. And sometimes it's pretty hard to get some of those big, sharp corners knocked off, isn't it? But then the lumps are a little smaller, so we go through a finer crusher. So the Lord is preparing us, perhaps not so roughly, but still a crushing is going on. Getting rid of the dross, the big chunks of rock that aren't necessary, and to break it down into smaller pieces so that it can be further broken down to get out what is wanted, the precious metal. And this... In this particular operation, this small piece, sort of pellet-sized ore, is trucked down to another crusher. And this is the final crushing. And from there, it goes into these... the final crushing is a rod mill. And there are large iron rods which roll around like this in a huge drum. And these small pieces of ore go into that drum, and these iron rods, going around and around, just pulverize these small bits of ore until what comes out of there is practically dust. Now, this is a very wonderful picture of what the Lord is doing to us, because we are being ground and crushed, not to destroy us, but to get rid of the impurities, what we don't want, so that what is left is precious. And just incidentally, to finish out the cycle, that dust, if you like to call it that, goes through water, and it goes onto a magnetic drum, and the iron ore is picked up on this magnetic drum and taken up out of the water, and then the magnetism is released and is dropped into another chute and is carried along further and into a drying drum, and the moisture is taken out and the dry, practically pure iron ore is dropped down into another belt and conveyed out into the ships, which take it into commerce and industry. But we want you to remember the illustration inasmuch as this crushing process that is going on in the lives of the Lord's people to get rid of the impurities and the waste rock and bring us down to the point where we are refined characters which can be used in the Lord's service. Now, the other illustration that we were thinking about was, we picked this up recently at a sales conference, and that was of the two men that were hired to cut down trees. One man was hired and told to cut down all the trees on that side of the mountain, and so he set to work and worked very hard. And the other man was sent, he was hired, and he went on the other side of the mountain to cut down trees with his trusty little axe. And they both worked, they were hired to work 8 hours a day, and they both worked their time. The one on one side of the mountain cut trees for 8 hours, but the man on the other side of the mountain only cut his trees for 7.5 hours. Now, which of those two men do you think cut the most trees down? Well, of course, automatically, you'd think the man that worked his full 8 hours. He was a good workman, conscientious, and he would have done more work than the fellow that only worked 7.5 hours. But the secret was that the man that worked 7.5 hours cut more trees down. And the reason for it was that the half hour a day that he wasn't cutting trees down, he spent sharpening his axe. That was a good idea, wasn't it? So you might draw lots of illustrations from that, but we thought we might liken our axe to our faith. And we must keep our faith sharp if we are going to continue to work in the Lord's service. And we thought that the thing that is used to sharpen an axe is a grindstone. And a grindstone isn't very smooth, usually. It's not rough like other types of abrasives, but it is rough enough to put a good sharp edge on your axe. So we thought perhaps we would give you that illustration so that you'll cut down lots of trees. You'll keep your axe sharp. You will keep your faith strong, a tool which will be used to best advantage as you continue to serve the Lord. Well, dear brethren, this trial of our faith involves both aspects of our faith. We may be sure that our intellectual assurance will be challenged. Do you understand the truth? Have you got a good knowledge of the truth in your head? Do you understand all the doctrines? And can you give a reason for the hope that is in you? Well, if you do, if you have this knowledge, don't rest on your oars, because I'm sure that it's going to be challenged. How important it is to gain a good understanding of the doctrines of the truth as soon as we can. Many of us have had the opportunity early in our Christian career of spending a lot of time studying and reading and thinking, meditating. One brother says to me, it's not good enough to read. He says, you've got to meditate on these things in order to let it sink in. So then, some of us have had this privilege and opportunity, and we've got a good groundwork, good understanding, a good knowledge of the truth. And maybe we never got that opportunity again. Life got too busy, and we didn't have time to spend like that, but we have had this good start, a good groundwork of knowledge. In 2 Timothy 4:3, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears. And if you have an itchy ear, you feel like scratching it, don't you? And probably what helps to scratch an itchy ear would be interesting little sidelights or new light or other kinds of information that comes to us to tickle our ears, which really shouldn't be used in case it damages our ears. So let's apply some salve if we have any itching ears, which would be the pure sound doctrines, no doubt. This principle can apply today, we think, for we have some in the movement of truth who would undermine our faith in some of these doctrines. Some of their reasonings may sound plausible, but if they are different from what we have been taught, then take care. We should be well enough grounded to recognize when a presentation is different. Let us keep our feet firmly on the floor under the Lord's table, as Brother Zano once put it. It is most essential that this knowledge of the truth, the foundation of our faith, be secure, for if the foundation is weak and can be moved, it will not be long before the superstructure is affected. And the illustration we're giving you is that the intellectual assurance is our foundation of knowledge, and the heart reliance, which we are coming to, is the superstructure of faith character building, which is built upon this foundation of knowledge or intellectual assurance. So if the basis is removed, you see how the superstructure cannot stand. If our foundation is secure, then we will have more success in maintaining our heart reliance, which will surely come under attack. One of the ways of the adversary is to discourage us. We want to be like that Christian who was able to resist discouragement so well that the imp became discouraged instead. And I think it was Sister Bessie Smith which told us this story. Years ago, I think Brother Copeland gave a talk in Victoria, and we weren't there for that talk, and Sister Bessie related it. If she didn't, at least this is the story. And that was that the devil wanted to discourage the Christian. And while I may have my story crossed up a little bit, I think I have the point. He sent the imp to discourage the Christian, and he went and sat on the Christian's shoulder, and he whispered in his ear that he was discouraged, and so on. And the Christian, he was full of zeal and faith, and no, he wasn't discouraged, go away. And the imp went back and reported, well, go back and try a little harder. So he tried this several times, and each time the Christian wouldn't be discouraged. And finally the imp went back to the devil, and he looked so downhearted, and what's the matter? Well, he said, I'm discouraged. So let's be like that Christian. We have lots of weaknesses. We've got lots of failures, brethren, to make us discouraged. But let's remember not to be discouraged, to take it to the Lord in prayer, and lean heavily on your faith, because it should be getting stronger all the time. A consideration of that perfect pattern makes us realize our own shortcomings, doesn't it? However, we must apply the promise that God is not looking at the flesh, but has made provision by covering us with the robe of Christ's righteousness. When we look at each other, we don't want to look at some of our weaknesses of the flesh, and who of us hasn't got any. We want to look at the robe of Christ's righteousness. I'm not sure. I think Brother Carson mentioned a point like that one time. We don't want to look under the robe. We want to look on the robe of Christ's righteousness, which each of our brethren have on. That is why they are brethren, isn't it? Yes, when I look at self, I tremble. But when I look to thee, I'm strong. My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. 2 Corinthians 12:9. We may also become discouraged, dear brethren, by the lack of results to our witnessing and in other efforts. We must realize that the John class on this side the veil must decrease. Everyone likes to see success, and it is hard to be enthusiastic in defeat. And that is what our cause looks like. We are few in number, and there may not be many who are interested in our message, but it is our faith that is on trial. So let's not, as they say these days, pack it up and not bother anymore. We have faith that soon the church will be glorified and the kingdom blessings will start, but nevertheless it still takes faith to continue to hold forth this message of truth. We won't take time to read Ecclesiastes 11:4-6. You know the story about sowing beside the waters. The Lord knows our needs as a class as well as individuals, and He will supply our needs if we will maintain our trust in Him. Dear brethren, are you sometimes depressed? Are you sometimes discouraged, like we shouldn't be? Well, try asking yourself why. Why are you discouraged? If you have to, write the reasons down. And then count your blessings, and like they do in business, put down one column and the other column and see which one has a greater total. If your blessings outweigh your reasons for being depressed, then throw the depressed ones away and keep your blessings. If it works the other way, then pray about it. Go to the Lord to increase your faith. Usually our blessings outweigh, and so a consideration of this type, we think, helps us to see the problems and to do something about them. Here again, usually we find that we are forgetting that we have a helper, a great burden bearer, our Lord Jesus. Our faith, dear friends, is being tested whether we will trust the Lord even sometimes where we cannot trace his leadings directly. So we will quote John 16:33, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulations, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." Therefore, dear brethren, review the promises, apply them to yourselves, they are still yours. The trial of your faith will continue until you are perfected. I would have liked to have read it, but we don't have time, so I will pass on this article. Reprints page 1822. The last paragraph in the article is very interesting. You have the reprints, page 1822. May the Lord bless you, and may the Lord add his blessing to the consideration of his word.
Thank you, Brother Wilk, for that goodly lesson of faith. How good illustrations are. Think of the sharpened axe, and immediately it calls many other illustrations to mind. And I thought immediately of the goodly bread that Sister Hannah is always baking and bringing down, and my dull knives at home. But the point would be that those sharp knives or that faith to cut the bread of truth, to believe it, and so forth. Yes. And now, Brother Wilk is asked to close with the singing of Appendix M. Appendix M. And we'll sing the first and last verse, please.
Thank thee for thy greatness and thy majesty, that thou hast condescended to look upon us and favor us with the truth. And we thank thee that this has been made possible through the gift of thy Son Jesus. We thank thee for his sacrifice and our privilege in walking in his footsteps. Wilt thou be with us for further sessions of this convention? Bless each heart bow before thee to remember thy people the world over in the interests of thy kingdom as it is manifesting itself in the earth.
forgive us our shortcomings, and grant us thy grace further. In Jesus' name we ask it.